I'll sit, I think. I'm the Steigerwald that was born without the performance gene. That's my big joke. My brothers have been on TV and radio and stage in front of 75,000 people.
But you're the man.
But I'm terrified of 40 of you. So this book took a long time to write. I started writing it when I was at the Post-Gazette, really. I did Sunday features in 1948, and then I just kept going and finally finished it. It came out last April. It sold decently, about 6,000 or 7,000 copies nationally, hardback. It might become a mass paperback. It might become a movie. I hope so. It'll pay me for all my hard work, because it's tough. But it's the story of Pittsburgh's greatest journalist, and his name was Ray Spriggle. He worked at the Post-Gazette from about 1911 to 1957. He won a Pulitzer in 38. He was a master of disguise. He went into coal mines as an undercover coal miner for a week, and then wrote about it in the Post-Gazette front page. He was a guard at Mayview State Hospital. He was a patient at Mayview, or at one of the state hospitals. He was a tremendous writer, a great reporter, a principled man. And in 1948, when he was 61, he decided that no one really knew, and he didn't know, what life was really like for the 10 million black Americans living in the Jim Crow South. America in 1948 had about 150 million people. 10% of them were black. 10 million of those 14 or 15 million lived in the South. So Spriggle decided, as he had done in the past, that the only way he was going to find out what it was really like was to go down to the Jim Crow South and live for about a month as a black man. Now, he was more German than I am, but he's, you know, this is what he looked like. He tried some chemicals, didn't work. Could have killed him probably in 1948. He was experimenting with patches on his chest. He hooked up with Walter White of the NAACP, the, you know, enormously important, dynamic leader. And so that White would get him a guide to guide him through the black world of the South, because obviously Spriggle wasn't going down there by himself. And when he talked to White and his friends, they said, look, just get a heavy, heavy, heavy tan. And, you know, when you get down in the South and you say you're a black man, no one's going to argue with you. No one's going to say, no, you're not. You're really a white guy, and come on up here in the front. And so that's what he did, and he went down for 30 days. He met a man named John Wesley Dobbs. Spriggle was a superstar. Dobbs was another superstar. From Atlanta, a black man, grandfather of the future first black mayor of Atlanta, Maynard Jackson Jr. He quoted Shakespeare. He was a self-taught, brilliant man, an important and pioneering civil rights leader in Atlanta. Spriggle and Dobbs met at Union Station in Washington, D.C., and took a Jim Crow train. Washington was essentially a Jim Crow town, not officially, but it was, down to Atlanta. And for the next 30 days, Spriggle lived at Dobbs's house in the best neighborhood, probably the richest neighborhood, black neighborhood in America, around the corner from Martin Luther King Jr., who was 19. And Dobbs was the host, and he had two cars in those days. Maybe 60% of the people even had one car. Dobbs had two cars. He wore the best suits. He was a Samuel L. Jackson is what he should play him in the movie. But so for 30 days they drove around the South. Dobbs took Spriggle to Savannah, to one trip to the Delta, and another trip. So it was. What happened then was Spriggle came back after 30 days. They didn't get any shootouts with the KKK. I'll leave that to Hollywood if they ever make a movie or a Netflix series out of this, which they should. Spriggle returned to Pittsburgh and wrote a 21-part series, front page. Spriggle, by the way, was a total celebrity in Pittsburgh. He was probably the first media celebrity. His iconic, he had this goofy hat. Everybody wore hats, but he had a funny hat and a stupid corncob pipe, but he had a whole bunch, you know, everybody knew him. And he had disappeared from the paper for about 4 months, and nobody knew where he was. And suddenly, he on the front page of the Post Gazette, for the first of 21 parts of his series. It was also syndicated around the country to only about 15 newspapers of the 130 it was offered to. And Spriggle was. We have some good writers here, I'm sure. Spriggle was a pretty amazing guy. Just so he had disappeared. Nobody knew where he went. Okay, and then he shows up on the front page in his disguise, not looking very black at that point, but in the way he dressed when he traveled through the Jim Crow South, the black world. And his opening paragraph, which we journalists always know is an important thing. I write in the book that Spriggle's byline had disappeared from the Post Gazette without explanation for 4.5 months. In his first paragraph, he summed up where he had been. And this is the quote, "For 4 endless crawling weeks, I was a Negro in the deep South. I ate, slept, traveled, lived black. I lodged in Negro households. I ate in Negro restaurants. I slept in Negro hotels and lodging houses. I crept through the back and side doors of railroad stations. I traveled Jim Crow in buses and trains and streetcars and taxi cabs. Along with 10 million Negroes, I endured the discrimination and oppression and cruelty of the iniquitous Jim Crow system." It was a typical, that's his opening graph. So. And meanwhile, you see his picture of him looking unlike anything they'd ever seen him look before. It was a typical Spriggle production, a strong opening, lots of colorful writing and strong opinions, and a generous sprinkling of sarcasm and hyperbole. Objectivity was neither practiced nor feigned, sounding a moral tone reminiscent of an old-style muckraking magazine writer. He woke up 300,000 Post-Gazette readers with the opening installment of a detailed, impassioned, and frequently bitter inside look at a part of America few of them knew or cared anything about. Along with exposing the petty workings of Jim Crow, he described what it felt like to know your rights of citizen. He described what it felt like to know, quote, that your rights of citizenship ran only as far as the nearest white man said they did. Now, my book opens this way, and I think this is probably the best thing to read. Just this, it's the opening. Juan Williams, the guy on Fox, the guy who used to be on NPR, makes several million dollars a year being on Fox, and a nice guy. He wrote a nice foreword for me. And this is chapter one, Jim Crow USA. You know what, this is driving me crazy. Does this still work like this? Okay. The two black men racing past the cotton fields in their 1947 Mercury were up to no good. Because their enormous dark green and chrome sedan attracted unwanted attention, they had to be cautious and alert as they crossed the Delta's vast grid of dirt roads and cotton plantations. No one white knew who they were or why they were in Mississippi, and they had to work extra hard to hide their sophistication and curiosity. The night before they drove into the Delta, friends in Jackson had briefed them on tactics, strategy, and proper behavior, as if they were a pair of elderly saboteurs about to be dropped into Nazi-occupied France. The men were warned not to stop and speak to sharecroppers working or walking along the roads. They were told never to argue with the riders who made up the armed mounted patrols that plantation owners used as field foremen and general overseers. They were also told not to talk too much in front of the white folks who held all the power and owned everything of value in the Delta. Above all, they were warned not to appear too interested in the dismal living conditions and suppressed civil rights of the huge black workforce that served King Cotton. The men appeared to be just a couple of accidental travelers, two innocent old gents from the big city of Atlanta. They were nothing of the sort. The 61-year-old in the passenger seat, wearing the floppy checkered hat and heavy black framed glasses, was an imposter. He called himself James Rael Crawford and carried a fake Social Security card in his wallet to prove it. But in actuality, he was Ray Spriggle, a nationally famous newspaper man from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He wasn't a light-skinned black visiting from the north. He wasn't even a black. He was 100% German-American white with a deep Florida tan, a spotless Republican voting record, and a 1938 Pulitzer Prize for proving a U.S. Supreme Court justice was a member of the KKK. That was Hugo Black, by the way. The only genuine black man in the speeding Mercury was the lead-footed 66-year-old driver, John Wesley Dobbs. Arguably the most influential black political and civic figure in Atlanta, he was a celebrated public speaker who had two cars and owned a handsome house in the wealthiest black neighborhood in America. Confident and driven, a flask of whiskey in his inside coat pocket, Dobbs could quote long poems and passages from Shakespeare from memory, and often preached his favorite civil rights gospel that the only way for blacks to achieve full freedom and equality was through the three B's: bucks, ballots, and books. It was May 27, 1948. Ray Spriggle had come down into the deep South to see and feel for himself how 10 million black Americans lived under the system of legal segregation known as Jim Crow. For nearly 3 weeks, he had been eating, sleeping, and living as a black man. Dobbs was his guide to the black world. Because he was the longtime grand master of Georgia's Prince Hall Masons fraternal group, he was known and trusted by middle-class blacks across the South. In Atlanta and in the small towns of rural Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee, Dobbs was introducing the undercover journalists to black doctors and undertakers, to sharecroppers, and to the families of lynching victims. When he told them Spriggle was gathering information for the NAACP, they believed it. Dobbs was also Spriggle's driver and protector. He knew how to comfortably and safely travel the South's dirt and clayback roads, where for black motorists, the bathrooms were usually in the bushes, and an uppity black man in a nice car could quickly find himself in serious trouble with white folks or the county sheriff. Spriggle was a seasoned newsman. He had spent time in the Deep South before. He had covered the Blitz in London in 1940 during World War II, gone undercover into state mental hospitals, and witnessed a dozen death penalty electrocutions. He was not a civil rights crusader or a soft-hearted liberal, but what he was seeing made him ashamed to be an American. Now he and Dobbs were passing through the deepest, meanest, poorest part of the Jim Crow South, where decades of strict racial segregation and white supremacy had achieved a feudal level of oppression, nearly 100 years after the end of slavery. If the wrong people in the Delta found out they were on a secret mission for a Yankee newspaper and were in cahoots with the boss of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, it could cost them their lives. So that's the beginning, and then it goes on from there. There's lots of history, lots of journalism, lots of 1948 pre-civil rights information and stuff, and it's Pittsburgh, it's Jim Crow South, I go backwards and then explain how Spriggle decided to do what he did and how he prepared, and then I use Spriggle's 21-part series, which if you go to the Post-Gazette, you can read. Do Spriggle and my name and it'll come up. I drew from that I was a history major. It finally came in handy, right? Not a footnote in this, I'm proud to say, but I wrote it like a giant Sunday newspaper feature, which I wrote scores of, I guess, for the Post-Gazette and the LA Times stuff. And I tried to make it, you know, tell a story, and there's a lot of facts and a lot of information and not a whole lot of poetry. Oh, but there was some poetry. Do I still have time? I forgot. There's actually a poetry connection. Okay. Chapter 11, Sneaking Through the Delta. And this is the poem by Langston Hughes, right? I couldn't use all of it because it would have cost me like 500, you know, the copyright thing is just, so you just take a part of it that you want and nobody ever bothers you, at least not yet. Year by year goes by and we are nothing more than a herd of Negroes driven to the field, plowing life away to make the cotton yield. That's from Sharecroppers by Langston Hughes. It went on and on after that, but I couldn't use it. Can I read a little bit more? Is that all right? Spriggle and Dobbs, this is chapter 11. Spriggle and Dobbs pushed north on Highway 61 in their big Mercury. If there hadn't been telephone wires strung along the road and Pepsi-Cola signs nailed to the fronts of the few colored cafes and general stores they passed, it could have been 1880. The brown fields on both sides of the two-lane highway were scattered to the horizons with ragged little columns of men, women, and children in overalls, printed cotton dresses, and wide straw hats. Sharecroppers. All of them were black. Some were in their 70s, some as young as 5. Heads bowed, eyes to the ground, they mechanically worked their long hoes in short chops as they moved among the rows of baby cotton plants they'd be tending until picking time in the fall. 500,000 black Americans lived in the Delta. Most were sharecroppers, day laborers, and tenant farmers. They and their large families lived in unpainted shotgun shacks that were on plantations as large as 20,000 acres or that were scattered randomly along the dirt and gravel roads. Tenant farmers who grew their own cotton on 10 acres of rented land worked 12-hour days, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Sharecroppers who paid their rent by giving their landlord about 30% of their crops often worked longer, from dawn to dusk, using tools, animals, fertilizer, seeds, and food that they bought from the landlord's store on credit. The sharecroppers and tenant farmers raised cotton from seed to bale. Like their grandparents, sharecroppers lived in shacks, walked behind one mule plows, weeded cotton rows with hoes, and handpicked 100 pounds of cotton balls a day under the baking Mississippi sun. Unlike their grandparents, they were not slaves, but they were close to it. In the most advanced country on Earth, 3 years into the atomic age, they were 19th century poor. They had no electricity, no running water, no property, no assets, no savings, no access to credit, no vote, no future in Jim Crow, Mississippi for themselves or their children. 15 miles west of Spriggle and Dobbs were the sharp bends and coils of the sleeping Mississippi River, which, along with the levees that had tamed it, formed the state's crinkled western edge. For thousands of years, its floods and the floods of its equally erratic junior partner, the Yazoo, had laid down the Delta's deep alluvial plain. An oval 200 miles tall by 70 miles wide in northwest Mississippi, the Delta stands like a teardrop between Memphis and Vicksburg. Flat as a griddle and spectacularly fertile, it's a perfect blend of climate and soil. The richest land this side of the Valley Nile is how plantation owner Big Daddy Pollitt described it, without exaggerating, in Tennessee Williams' play, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Thank you.
Thank you.